Good morning. Let's see, my notes tell me that this morning we may have students from Randolph High School. If that's the case, would they please stand with their advisor? Two of you, eh?
Look at all those medals.
Yes, wow. My goodness. Well, thank you very much for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with our program called Court with Class, so they've had materials that will give them a little bit of information about what you're going to argue for us today. Now, I don't know, are you going to be able to stay at noon? If you are, Justice Kelly will come chat with you a little bit. Do you know what your schedule is like? You'll stay? Okay, all right. Well, then after the second argument, Justice Daniel Kelly, who sits down here at the far left-hand side of the bench, at least left for me, is going to come and he'll talk with you a little bit about the procedure, not the merits of the case, but about the procedure and how cases get to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Okay, well, with that preliminary matter out of the way, I will call State versus Anthony Jones, 15 AP 2665. Are you prepared to proceed?
I am.
Please do.
I'm Andrew Hinkle from the State Public Defender Appellate Office here in Madison. I represent Anthony Jones, and may it please the court. Starting with the Daubert case, we've had a lot of talk about what it means to be reliable, what reliability is. We spent a lot of words saying what it isn't, and after several months thinking about it, I personally have come to the conclusion that I can't define my way into an understanding of what reliability is. I think, as Professor Blinka said, when you look at the old Frye standard that Daubert replaced in the federal system, and the old Wisconsin standard that Daubert replaced here, he called it, I think he said that the Frye standard was too hot, and the Wisconsin standard was too cold, and Daubert is, allegedly anyway, just right. So
If you can understand it and apply it.
Right. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to figure out what is just right. And I think when we do that, what we're really talking about is how hard is a court going to look at expert evidence that's proffered to it.
When you say how hard is the court going to look at it, Mr. Hinkle, I think in my preparations for this, what you're actually referring to is how in-depth, how behind, how underneath the representations of the experts are we going to require our trial courts to roll up their sleeves and to say, well, the experts are saying that this is reliable, but I have to delve into the underlying research, as I did and as we were preparing. I see some of my colleagues also have some materials looking into these two actuarial tools. By the way, I have to compliment you in your brief. It was the nicest, clearest explanation of actuarial tool that I've seen.
Well, thank
so
you,
thank
Justice
you for that.
Thank you.
We're probably going to steal part of that, at least somewhat adapted for one of our opinions. So that's thank you for that. But really, if the expert is telling the trial court judge, this is a tool that some people use. Now, certainly, do you wonder why they're still using data from the 50s, 60s, 70s about a certain limited pool of inmates who were released, and then they tracked the recidivism rate of those, and that's where it ended? You certainly think to yourself, and you don't have to be a judge or even a lawyer or even particularly gifted in any way to kind of think, well, gee, why don't they use a more updated version? But if the experts are relying on it, and the experts who are, what would you tell our circuit court judges to do in the same way you explained the definition of actuarial tool? What is the rule that you would want to have emerge from this case for our instruction to our circuit courts?
I think, Justice Gableman, the basic rule, the basic rule that I'm proposing is that you can't evaluate the reliability of expert testimony without talking about the expert or talking about whatever the data is.
Now, the negative, you can't. I'm sorry, you can't.
Oh, that's all right. You can't adequately exercise your discretion in determining the reliability of expert testimony without talking about the instruments or the tests or whatever it is that the expert is talking about.
She did that here. She said she used the analogy, which she borrowed from somebody else with credit, of the older car on the automobile, the older car on the road. And, gee, it doesn't have all the safety features of the new car, but it's still a car and it's still serviceable. So why isn't that enough?
Well, I think you could say that about essentially any testimony. You could say, hey, this testimony has problems, but it could be worse.
Really? I mean, a phrenologist comes and says, I examined the patient, and according to my phrenology.
I think we can all agree that phrenology is probably beyond the pale.
So how do we draw the line? Where is the rule that we articulate? That's what we're going to be called upon to do, to articulate a rule. And this is where I think you're going to have some difficulty coming up with something.
Yeah, as I said when I started, I have a hard time coming up with a rule that explains all of what the Daubert standard is.
So why not? Why is she wrong when she says it's an issue of weight to be evaluated by the jury and not one of admissibility, and let the defense attack it in the, you know, I used a thumbnail sketch of the Canadian test, of a very limited pool, very relatively small numbers, and the defense lawyer is certainly free to explore all of that in front of the jury and bring it out. And ladies and gentlemen of the jury, how can we judge a matter as important as this on data that is half a century old?
No, I guess the underlying notion of Daubert is that cross-examination isn't always sufficient to expose evidence that's just not reliable. That's what, you know, the Daubert court said. That expert evidence can often have an undue influence on a jury just because they don't have the specialized knowledge that would be required to evaluate that reasonably. Of course, judges, you know, are not necessarily experts in whatever testimony is coming before them either. However, a judge does have the opportunity to dig a little bit deeper, educate him or herself by way of these sorts of hearings, learning about whatever is presented, reading reports that are presented, so that they can make, you know, essentially look at the instrument and say, hey, does this tell us what it says it's telling us?
Is there anything in the record here to indicate the trial judge did not read reports that were presented to her or did not question experts? It seems to me what you're saying is educate themselves and then what? And then have a hearing about what is the most reliable or what is not reliable and have a trial before the trial? Is that what they're supposed to do?
No, I don't think the standard is what is the most reliable. We can
all
agree that simply, you know, the fact that one expert says X and the other expert says Y doesn't mean that either one of those opinions is excludable. That's very frequently stated. What a trial court needs to do, though, and I can't tell you whether she read the reports, she issued an oral decision at the end of the second day of the hearing.
That's why I asked if there was anything in the record to indicate she did not.
Well, what the record indicates is that the decision, the oral ruling that she actually gave, barely mentions the actual instruments that she was evaluating the reliability of. It doesn't mention at all the problems with those instruments that Mr. Jones's expert and the evidence that he presented exposed. Now, I mean, I guess she addressed it in the sense of drawing this car analogy, but again, that's not really talking about the instruments themselves. When Mr. Jones presents evidence that the Minsost R does no better than a coin flip in deciding who's a recidivist and who's not, there's nothing in the court's decision that explains why either that's wrong or why that's okay. I mean, that strikes me as a pretty big problem with this evidence that needs to be addressed in any valid exercise of discretion.
All right. So, counsel, you want the court to look at the bones of Minsaw Star and Razor to determine whether they have any predictive power, right?
That's right.
Okay. Now, in your petition and in your briefs, it appears that you're challenging the use of Minsaw Star and Razor, but I believe the Static 99 tool was used as well. Is that right?
That is true.
And are you challenging the use of Static 99?
No, that was challenged at the circuit court level, but having looked at all the claims that were made, I chose these two as the ones that I thought I was going to continue to pursue.
All right. So is there any value in looking at what Minsaw Star and Razor said with respect to Mr. Jones and comparing that to what Static 99 said about Mr. Jones?
I'm not sure I followed the question.
All right. So all of these tools, and correct me if I'm wrong, all of these tools are designed to predict the risk of reoffending.
Yes. Correct.
Okay. So presumably, if Static 99 was used in this case, it provided the expert with some information about the risk of reoffense. Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. So did you compare what Static 99 said about Mr. Jones against what Razor and Minsaw Star said about Mr. Jones?
I don't recall what the figures were that those came up with. But as I was saying, I limited my challenge to I'm still trying to decide how to pronounce this, the Minsaw Star.
That'll work.
And the Razor. Because of the flaws in those instruments that were exposed at this hearing and because of the fact that the court didn't really address them.
But isn't that significant only if they're outliers to Static 99?
I mean, I suppose that would potentially be an issue if there was if they all came out the same, then perhaps there could be a harmlessness argument. The state hasn't made that argument, and I don't know if they all came out the same. I think that, even if, suppose they all did give the same estimates, I think there's still a problem in presenting, if the state, I don't remember how many there were. I think there are four instruments that the state was relying on between two experts. And if the jury hears, hey, two of these instruments say he's dangerous, and he has an expert saying, well, these two instruments or my various other calculations say he's not, I think that's different than the state, having a couple of more. I mean, that's why they do present multiple expert witnesses. That's why they present multiple, at least one of the reasons, ostensibly, that they present multiple tests is to drive home, hey, all of these things are coming out the same, so I'm right.
Okay. I want to get your response to a couple of things that the state said. The state says, quote, the Minsaw Star also had a reliability score of 0.72.
Would you speak up, please?
Oh, sure.
Thank you.
The state says, quote, the Minsaw Star also had a reliability score of 0.72 on a recent meta-analysis. An analysis of analyses performed on the Minsaw Star, which is, quote, consistent with moderate reliability. I presume you saw that in their brief.
Yes.
Do you agree with that?
I don't have any independent knowledge of that, but I have no reason to doubt it.
Okay. If a tool that is used to essentially predict the future has moderate reliability, is that sufficient for Daubert purposes?
Well, I mean, I would love to be here attacking the use of all actuarials in Chapter 980 because I do think that it makes me a little bit nervous when we have instruments that have a very high failure rate and we're going to a jury and saying, hey, if you find that this guy is over 50% likely to commit another sex offense, you lock him up. Well, you don't tell the jury that, but that's what happens. You lock him up, potentially for life. I think that's a problem. But your question, I think, it gets to one of the problems with Dr. Durek's testimony, which is that he was saying, well, 0.71 on the Razor, I think, and they're saying 0.72 on Minsaw Star. But that measure is not actually a measure. That's a measure of basically what we call relative dangerousness. It ranks, it's a measure of the testability to say, well, this guy's more dangerous than this guy. But that's not the question that the jury is asked, and that's not the evidence that's presented at a trial. You go to a 980 trial, you don't hear the experts getting up there and saying, well, this guy is more dangerous than 60% of people, or he's more dangerous than 30%, or he's 1 in 10. What they say is, based on this instrument, he has a 57% chance. They don't say it that way. They always take a step back and say, other people like him have a 57% chance. But the thrust of it is, this guy has a 57% chance of committing another sex offense. That 57% has no connection whatsoever with that 0.71 or 0.72. That absolute risk that the instruments give is usually the main issue in these trials. It's the thing that they fight about constantly, and nothing that Dr. Jurek said at all said that, you know, he didn't provide any evidence, any research saying that those numbers are accurate, and those are the numbers that matter.
Counsel, you focus only on one part of the expert's testimony, but as the circuit court evaluates the reliability of the expert's opinion, there's considerably more there than the use of these risk assessment tools, correct?
I agree that the reports have more to them than the risk assessments.
Well,
yes.
They examined the defendant. They had personal medical beliefs about what they saw.
Sure.
And appeared to say that the test validated what they saw in person, not that what they saw in person was driven by the results of the test. So I'm a little bit concerned about your focus, because I think the circuit court is to evaluate the reliability of the expert's opinion. It's not that the circuit court is to evaluate the reliability of whether Razor is a good tool or not. Correct?
I guess I would disagree with that. I think that when you're doing Daubert, it's not an all or nothing proposition. It's not as if the court has to say everything that Dr. Jurek has to say is valid. I think the court's certainly free and should say, well, some of this testimony is okay. Some of this testimony is reliable. Some of this testimony is something that a jury ought to be hearing. Some of it, frankly, is not. I mean, you see those rulings. If you look at appellate decisions, you know, from other jurisdictions, we don't have very many such decisions. You see a wide range of how closely courts are looking at this.
Your focus will not change the court's decision on the reliability of the expert's testimony unless it requires affirmance of the results of the risk assessment tools. And I didn't think either expert based their testimony totally on risk assessment tools. It was one other thing they looked at. But they didn't say that we wouldn't have come to this conclusion without this result on the risk assessment tools.
The expert's ultimate opinion on dangerousness is not the only evidence that the jury hears. They don't just get up and say, hey, I looked at a bunch of stuff and I think he's dangerous. They say, you know, they tell the jury, you know, here are the reasons why I think he's dangerous. And so when they, I think, I mean, again, having read a few 980 trials, you very frequently see a lot of talk about what percentage chance these have, what percentage risk these people are based on these instruments, and you give that to the jury. And the question to my mind is that evidence reliable? And if it's not, they shouldn't be hearing it. I mean, the jury isn't required to credit Dr. Jurek's opinion, and it's not required to credit anything he says, but it could well be that the jury, usually we expect juries to evaluate expert testimony based in part on what the experts say, not merely their opinion.
Right. Well, I understand that. But the gatekeeping function that the trial court plays is to make a determination on whether the expert's opinion is relevant and reliable, right? Aren't those the two things that the court has to look at before an expert gets to testify under Daubert?
I agree that those are the Daubert standards, but I don't think that we can just say opinion, you know, opinion encompasses everything the expert could possibly say, and if overall we think that most of what he has to say is valid, then he gets to say anything he likes.
Well, that's not what I'm saying, and you know that's not what I'm saying.
No, I guess I don't understand.
Okay, all right. Well, never mind.
90702 in part requires, and this is the statute that implements the Daubert standard, that the test... That it's admissible, the testimony is the product of reliable principles and methods. So it seems to me that we have to focus on the reliability of the principles and methods utilized, applied by the witness. And the witness has applied the principles and methods reliably. So we have to make sure under 90702 that the result, the instrument, is based on reliable principles and methods, and that the witness has applied the principles and methods reliably to the facts of the case. I think that's what the jury instructs us. Of course, comes to my mind the case of Loomis that we had in a different setting, but dealing with risk assessments. The different setting was at sentencing, and the rules of evidence don't apply at sentencing, and there's much greater discretion, much broader arena of what can come before the court. In that case, we indicated that we are not in a position to evaluate or opine on the scientific reliability of the underlying instrument. We also went through the discussion of the proponents for use of this kind of instrument. I'm talking about Compass. And the opponents and the studies done by the opponents that call into question the reliability of Compass. And what the court did was say, okay, all pre-sentence reports have to have the certain information set forth, almost disclaimers as to the nature of a Compass risk estimate. it has to emphasize that they're based on group data, not to a particular defendant. And, of course, the Department of Corrections said that over and over again. One of the things that the pre-sentence has to indicate is that Compass is a proprietary nature. And so the underlying data hasn't been disclosed. Are either of these instruments of proprietary nature?
No. No, the data is publicly available.
The underlying algorithms and the basis for those algorithms are publicly available for
That's
both
correct.
Of these. So what do you think about maybe a jury instruction to cure your concern, advising the jury of limitations? I mean, certainly there are limitations on these instruments, and I'm not sure a circuit court is always in a position, as we were not, to opine on the underlying, to evaluate or opine on the scientific reliability of the data. And yet they're kind of called upon to do that vis-a-vis Daubert. So we've got a conundrum here, and maybe jury instruction is the best thing to do, and then if otherwise qualified, kind of revert to the old, you know, weight. There's a difference between weight and credibility and reliability, though. But what do you think about jury instruction?
I mean, as a practical matter, if we didn't have Daubert, then I think we would be asking for jury instructions like that, perhaps. And we would certainly have, as we did have here, cross-examination, trying to expose, hey, you know, maybe these instruments don't say what they say they say. But what we have in Daubert is expressly a standard that the legislature has imposed that says, hey, some of this stuff just shouldn't go before the jury. Now, of course, you can sometimes give curative instructions when a jury hears things that it's not supposed to hear. But again, the point of Daubert is not that, hey, it's a free-for-all and we'll, you know, take care of it via cross and closing argument and jury instructions. What Daubert says is judges are supposed to look and see whether this is reliable enough to get in front of a jury. And I agree with you. It's a burden. It's a burden. It can be a burden on the courts, or at least on the bench, to educate themselves, to make themselves competent enough in a particular area to make sense of these things.
You know, Mr. Henkel, in one of your responses to my questions, you indicated that Daubert kind of disfavors cross-examination as the means of testing this kind of information, but I'm reading a direct quote from Daubert where it says, vigorous cross-examination, presentation of contrary evidence, and careful instruction on the burden of proof are the traditional and appropriate means of attacking shaky but admissible evidence. And when you come back for rebuttal, you have, we've talked a lot, but so far I have not heard you articulate what Daubert standard, I haven't heard you articulate all of the Daubert standards, and then what, if any, the trial court judge missed in this instance.
You're speaking specifically about the discretionary factors that are articulated in Daubert?
The suggested non-exclusive list, yes.
Sure, right.
Because that seems to me a main focus of why we're here.
Sure. Though in response to your premise, the first part of what you said?
Yes, sir.
I would note that paragraph is quoted a lot. It's quoted a lot by the state. If you look at the following paragraph, though, the court sort of provides caveats and says, you know, yeah, cross-examination is the appropriate means for challenging, you know, most evidence that we're feeling a little about. But,
Shaky.
But it then goes on to say, and I don't recall the direct quote, but it basically, again, backtracks and says, but hey, some stuff just shouldn't come before the jury, and cross-examination isn't going to cut it. Science has a greater tolerance for bad ideas, wrong ideas, than the law can, because we think, at least, in the world of science, given enough time, those bad ideas will out. Eventually, they'll go away. In legal cases where we're trying to decide, you know, justice, and we're deciding matters that can be, again, potentially a lifetime problem for someone, we have a smaller realm of...
I think the state's point, Mr. Henkel, is if the tests are so bad, and there are so many better tests out there, that a little preparation and a little cross-examination would make that point obvious to the trier of fact.
And I guess I would respond that the notion behind Daubert is that some things are, juries are not necessarily equipped, even with the benefit of cross-examination, to understand when the science that's being presented to them is not really science or is outdated and no longer useful.
I'm still curious to know what the trial court judge missed about Daubert.
Absolutely.
Well, it looks to me from some of the language that all you have to do is say, well, this isn't junk science. If it's junk science, it's out. But if it's short of junk science, it's in. Well, there's a lot of stuff that isn't junk science, but still is not reliable.
My red light is on. Can I respond briefly?
You can respond, yes.
I guess I'd say, you know, I thought about this. Junk science is really sort of in the eye of the beholder. It's a pejorative term where we're describing, you know, something that we think is wrong, not believable for whatever reason. These instruments, you know, have been discarded largely. And, you know, things that are discarded we often call junk.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Assistant Solicitor General Amy Miller on behalf of the State of Wisconsin.
Would you pull that microphone closer to you?
Sure.
Thank you.
The trial court here did exactly what trial courts are supposed to do when evaluating expert testimony under Wisconsin Statute 90702. The court applied the proper legal standard. It understood its role as gatekeeper to ensure that proffered expert testimony is reliable. It utilized the Daubert factors to assess the reliability of the contested methodology and reasonably found, based on ample record evidence, that the methodology here satisfied the standards of reliability and that, therefore, the expert's testimony was admissible. Now, Jones' criticisms of the trial court's decision below and of the tools themselves misunderstands both the role of the trial courts under 90702 and the tools themselves. What the trial courts are doing at the admissibility stage is simply determining whether evidence is or methodology is reliable. They are not supposed to determine conflicting opinions of experts, decide between different reasonable opinions of the experts. They're not supposed to take deep fact-finding expeditions into whether or not these particular criticisms are or not correct. They're simply just determine whether there are good grounds for the expert's testimony, whether the methodology is based in the knowledge and experience of the relevant discipline. That is what the Daubert factors are designed to uncover.
Counsel,
you know, that sounds an awfully lot like the old Wisconsin approach, and that is, as long as it's a qualified expert with a pedigree and a resume
to extol, that that's going to be enough. And yet Daubert brought something new. Daubert brought 90702, which requires the reliability of the underlying methodology and principles. How is a judge to assess that in this context without hearing expert testimony and basing it on perhaps controverted expert testimony? Is he supposed to do it without accord to expert testimony? I didn't quite follow that.
Well, in this case, the court did hear expert testimony on these tools. There are cases that a court might not need to hear such testimony in which an expert's methodology, as Fumo Tire explained, may properly be taken for granted. In this case, the court did hear from various experts and determined using the Daubert factors, which are part of a non-exhaustive list of factors that courts can look to depending on the circumstances of the case, depending on the facts, the kind of testimony the expert is giving. These factors can be very useful in determining whether something is based in the knowledge of the discipline.
I read your brief to really focus in part on the what I call the standard of review. That is, the circuit court exercised its discretion and admitted this testimony. If the circuit court had determined that the underlying data here was not reliable under its exercise of discretion, would you be here?
I think that we would be arguing, perhaps, that that was an erroneous exercise of discretion based on the record in this case. The record in this case does not provide the court with any evidence that these tools are, in fact, unreliable. While Jones' experts had several theories about why the tools were unreliable, he didn't provide the court with any actual evidence that the tools are unreliable. On the other side, the state provided mountainous evidence, and the experts referred to numerous studies that were conducted, all finding that these tools have predicted validity.
So in the next case, if they have an expert, if the defense has an expert that can produce and does, I thought here there were studies too, but maybe I'm wrong, that can produce studies that show it's unreliable, then what? Then is there a different result with regard to Razor, and you would affirm the discretion exercised by the court?
I think that would be a different case if the court were presented with evidence and perhaps some consensus among the field that these tools are, in fact, unreliable, that there were some studies conducted that consistently showed over and over again that these tools had no predictive validity.
Well, hold it. I mean, you're going, you know, so oftentimes we don't, it's not black or white. There's a lot of gray in life and in the law. And so I said that studies that question or call into question the reliability, not that they're absolutely inaccurate, period, but and a court, based on that testimony, determined that it was not admissible because it wasn't sufficiently a showing of reliability. What's your position?
Well, every case is going to depend on its facts, so that would depend on the facts of the studies and the expert testimony that was presented to the court, and the court would then weigh the evidence for reliability, the evidence against reliability, and make a determination. And the courts are given great leeway in making this determination because it is so difficult in every case. Every case is going to be different, even cases involving the same kind of testimony, even cases involving these actuarial risk assessment tools. Each case is going to be different. It's going to present a different set of facts, different experts using the tools perhaps in different ways. And so the courts are given great leeway to determine whether or not the tools are reliable. But in this case, based on the evidence before this court, the trial court made an entirely reasonable conclusion that the tests were admissible based on the evidence that was placed before it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that reliability. On page 10 of your brief, you say that the MnSAW-STAR also had a reliability score of 0.72 on a recent meta-analysis, which is consistent with moderate reliability. Now, Mr. Hinkle has suggested that that relates to dangerousness as opposed to recidivism. What say you? What did that moderate reliability refer to?
So that score of 0.72 that was referenced by Dr. Jurek in his testimony of a meta-analysis on the MNSOSTR, but those scores are called area under the curve scores. What they do is they tell us at what rates the tools are rating someone who reoffended higher than they're rating someone who did not reoffend.
Right, but is it measuring recidivism or is it measuring something else?
It's measuring the ability of the tool to predict risk, to predict
risk
the risk of recidivism.
Thank you.
Of reoffense. And so about 72% of the time, the tools are rating someone who's at a higher risk who does reoffend higher than someone who does not. And so we can say generally that these tools are getting a higher score on these tools is generally associated with a higher risk of recidivism.
All right. Now, my understanding is that the static 99 tool was employed in this case?
Yes, it was, as was the static 99R.
Okay. And do you know what the static 99 and static 99R said about Mr. Jones' risk of recidivism, and how did that compare to the MnSOS-R and the RAISR?
Yes, so Dr. Jurek, the state's expert, the only expert whose testimony is at issue here, used four tools, the MNSOSDR, RAISR, Static 99, and Static 99R, all to evaluate Jones. All of those tools scored Jones high risk, and all of the percentages that they gave for the group data that each of the tools had followed, different groups of different offenders, at the longest term that they were followed for, so either 10 years for the RAISR, 15 for the Static 99, or 6 for the MNSOSTR, they all gave very similar percentages. So 55% for the RAISR, 52% for the Static 99, 55% again for the Static 99R, and 57% for the MNSOSTR. So they were all within a few percentage points of one another. And so Dr. Jurek called this convergent validity. This showed that all of these different tools, which are all capturing different aspects of risk, of recidivism, were pointing in the same direction. They were all showing that Jones was a high risk to reoffend in all of the different group data, which does not translate to an individual's risk of reoffense. This is simply group data, a number of people that were followed, 55% of them generally over the course of 6 or 10 years ended up reoffending. That, again, is not Jones' risk of reoffense. And I think we're misunderstanding a bit how these tools are used, what these experts do with these tools. All these tools do is provide the experts with information, with group data, with risk factors that have been shown through empirical research to correlate with a risk of recidivism.
Right. So they take that group data and what it tells them, and they use that in a particular case to develop a risk of reoffense, yes?
They call it an anchor or a baseline for their individualized assessment. So what they have to do is look at individual factors for this particular person. Even the factors on the tools can only capture a person's risk in a generalized sense.
There's right, but they are used. So
yes, the, yes. They've
right,
been
so the expert would take those four tools, and that will feed into his analysis to determine, is this person at a high risk of reoffense? Yes?
Correct, high or low risk, whatever he ends up determining. And the reason that the experts in the field do this, and this is across the board, across the nation, all experts who do these kinds of evaluations use some kind of actuarial risk assessment tool, because it's been shown that using these tools improves the accuracy of their risk assessments above simple clinical judgment. And so while they don't rely entirely upon these tools, they all use these tools as a baseline, as an anchor for their individualized assessment. But they in no way use the scores, the percentages that they're given by these tools to say, yep, this is Jones' risk of reoffense. He's 55% likely to reoffend. What they do is they look at that information. They know what the groups are, too, where this information comes from. They understand, for example, the MNSOSTR was a sample of offenders from back in the 80s and 90s,
yeah,
that they were reoffenders, that there were no incest offenders, etc.
Yeah. So can you give me a sense of how significant this source of information is to the expert in performing his individualized assessment of whether Mr. Jones is a high risk of reoffending? Does this constitute 5% of the information he relies on? Is it 95%? How important is this?
I think that's going to depend on the experts and on the evaluators. With regard to Dr. Jurek in particular, I'd say it was a small percentage. It was definitely a very small percentage of the evidence that the jury heard at trial, and I think it was probably a small percentage of his assessment as well. This is kind of their starting point. This is what they begin by doing. They start by using these tools to get an idea. If I'm getting someone who's got high scores across the board, that's kind of a red flag that they might be high risk. They're showing a lot of risk factors on these tools. But then they dive into the individual's history, and in this case, they had hundreds of pages of records on Jones that they poured through to determine not only his level of risk, but also whether they could assign him a diagnosis of a mental disorder, which is another portion of the 980 requirements that caused him to be more likely than not to reoffend. So the tools themselves, while they are a part, and these tools are just a part of Dr. Jurek's overall analysis.
So when he provides his individualized assessment for Mr. Jones, does he also provide a confidence factor in his assessment?
He opines to a reasonable degree of professional certainty, that kind of confidence
but
factor.
But in a statistical sense, though, he doesn't give a confidence factor.
No, not any kind of number or anything like that. So again, based on the information before the trial court simply needed to look to whether this information was reliable, not whether it was unassailable, not even whether it was the best methodology or the most recent methodology. That is not the standard under Daubert. The standard is simply whether there are good grounds for this testimony, whether these methods are based in the knowledge of the discipline. And that is what the Daubert factors are meant to uncover: peer review, testing, known error rates, general acceptance. All of these factors point to something being grounded in the knowledge of the discipline. And here, there was ample evidence placed before the trial court that these tools had been peer-reviewed, that they had been tested continuously, that they were found always to have moderate predictive validity, and that is why they were generally accepted in the professional community. There was no evidence presented by Jones to undermine any of these findings, aside from the criticisms of his expert, which may or may not be valid. They were unsupported in front of the trial court. But again, the trial court correctly left this for the finder of fact. Issues of credibility, competing testimony by the experts, competing opinions of the experts are for the finder of fact. And that is what Daubert explained at the beginning. Daubert explained that, you know, we're not trusting juries as much as we should. Juries can handle shaky but admissible evidence. Cross-examination and presentation of contrary evidence is the proper means for testing shaky evidence. While these tools may or may not be shaky evidence, they are certainly reliable, they are certainly admissible. And all of Jones' criticisms of the tools could and were brought out in front of the jury. If there are no further questions.
I say this in part as returning to those thrilling days of yesteryear and the Wisconsin's rule on expert testimony. I see this really as long as you have a expert that is qualified. Qualified, dignified, and presentable, that the opinion is going to go to the jury and let the jury give such weight and credibility to the witness and weight to the testimony as it deserves. That's what I really see this doing. I see, so tell me why this is more than just that.
So the standard here, while it encompasses the old standard, right, the expert must be qualified and their testimony must be helpful, there is more to it than that at this point. The trial court must take a closer look at the underlying methodology, at how the expert applied that methodology, the facts and data that the expert was using, and that is what the court did here. That is what was contained in both the motion to bar testimony and the response to the motion was a lot of talk about the reliability of these tools that never would have come up under the old standard. And the entire two-day hearing, motion hearing before the court, was information that the court would not have needed to consider under the old standard. It was all are these tools reliable? The Daubert factors of peer review, testing, error rates, general acceptance were not things that the trial court would have ever considered under the previous standard. And now while the standard for reliability is not a very high bar, it's not perfection, it's not unassailability, it's not certainty, it is still higher than the old standard. There is still more that the trial court is required to do, and more that the trial court here did in fact do. Its analysis of the Daubert factors and the reliability of the methods, of the tools here, would never have been done under the old standard.
And that's what I expected you to lead with. I expected you to say more or less what the Court of Appeals said in regard to the trial court's application of Daubert. In denying Jones's motion, the circuit court considered the Daubert factors and then went through the Daubert factors. They were the product of sufficient facts or data that the product of and product of reliable principles and methods. The submission to the scrutiny of the scientific community. The court noted that the challenged instruments were not junk science, as Justice Abrahamson quoted, and were widely used in predicting recidivism in sex offenders. And it's something that's in your brief, which I haven't heard you mention yet, unless maybe the fact has changed in between the authorship of the brief and today, that in no other court in the land have these tests been rejected under Daubert.
That's true, under any evidentiary standard, and that continues to be true to this day. The state is unaware of any court in any jurisdiction that has rejected these tools under an evidentiary objection. And so again,
how many cases were there?
Under the various standards, they were not all Daubert standards. Some used the Frye standards, some used some variation between the two, but there were at least a half a dozen cases that the state noted. There are likely more than that, and it's possible that these cases are coming up, but they're just not being published, they're not being reported, because these tools are so common and so widely accepted that their reliability can almost be taken for granted in some cases. But here, the court did not just take their reliability for granted. The court held a hearing, heard evidence for 2 days, considered all of the facts before it, and again, reasonably based on sufficient evidence in the record, determined that these tools are reliable. It's not the role of the trial court at the admissibility stage to become a trier of fact, to make credibility determinations between the competing views of the experts. So long as experts' testimony is grounded in the expertise and the knowledge of the discipline, so long as it's not junk science, so long as there are good grounds for the testimony is admissible, and any challenges to that testimony should be tested through the traditional avenues of cross-examination and the presentation of contrary evidence. That is exactly what happened here, and that is exactly how 90702 was designed to work.
If the court had determined that these two tests, which opposing counsel complains of, were not based on reliable methodology or principles, would the expert's testimony have been excluded, or what would happen then?
Certain parts of the expert's testimony would have been excluded. The motion to bar testimony sought to exclude any testimony relating to these tools. It didn't seek to exclude the expert's opinion in whole. And so the jury would have simply not heard testimony on the razor and the MNSOSTR, which was just a very, very small portion of what they ended up hearing at trial.
Would counsel be prohibited from cross-examining the expert witness and saying, well, you know, you had relied when you formed your testimony, at least in part, on two tests that the trial court has found to be unreliable based on poor methodology or not reliable methodology. Would that be fair cross-examination for such an expert witness who went forward when he couldn't or she couldn't mention these two tests?
I'm not necessarily sure that that would be a fair cross-examination, especially by the party who brought the motion to bar the testimony to then bring in testimony about the tools.
Now, that also might open a big hole to say what the tools show if you
if you brought that up in cross-examination.
Right, so, then that would open the door to the other side to then bring in evidence that had previously been barred.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
I'm concerned about rubber stamping this kind of evidence, and I understand the four elements that the trial court went through. In part, those elements rest on, well, everyone else is doing it, or no court has thus far declared these instruments bad, is another way of saying it. And 2 years ago, I had an occasion to read all sorts of studies and law review articles that showed a skepticism, including the Department of Justice itself, having a real skepticism about the validity of these tools. And I came away from that rather intensive exercise of focusing on this for several months, reading all the time different reports, that like the lie detector test that everyone used and was admissible and then it wasn't all that reliable after a while, that there is room for a healthy skepticism about the use of these tools, and maybe even more. I mean, there are experts that think that they are being misused. How do you address that? How can our system of justice take into account that these are pretty good, but maybe they're not all that they're cracked up to be?
I think that's going to depend in each case on what tools you're talking about, how the experts are using them, and what evidence is presented to the trial court. But Daubert allows for there to be debate about methodology without rendering that methodology inadmissible. The advisory committee notes to Rule 702 explain that Rule 702 is meant to be broad enough to encompass competing expert testimony that is based on competing methodology. And so the fact that there is some debate, as there will always be with any kind of expert testimony and any kind of science or technical knowledge, isn't enough to render something inadmissible under the evidentiary standards. Now, whether this court wanted to adopt some kind of other standards with regards to this tool outside of 90702 is another question, but the rule of 90702 is broad enough to encompass this skepticism, this debate that is part of science, is part of any profession, and is what the trial court here heard was debate between experts, qualified experts, about these tools and about their efficiency, about their utility and their reliability, and reasonably concluded that this was for the jury to hear, that these tools are reliable, that they've been tested and accepted in the field, and they meet the threshold. That doesn't mean they're correct, and that doesn't mean that the jury should credit them, but that means that they are admissible.
I did not understand the state's argument to be that our circuit court should be a rubber stamp, nor did I understand the state's primary argument to rest on the fact that no other jurisdiction in the land has rejected these tests. Instead, and correct me if I'm wrong, what I understand the state's argument to be is that Daubert is the standard, Daubert was applied, and there's nothing on the record to show that Daubert was applied incorrectly. Am I mistaken?
No, that's absolutely correct. The court here did not act simply as a rubber stamp for these tools. The court heard 2 days of testimony. The court considered the evidence placed before it, considered the competing views of the experts, and used the Daubert standard, went through each of the factors, and determined that these tools were reliable based on these factors. Now, the court did bolster its opinion with the fact that these tools had not been rejected in any other jurisdiction, but that was not the basis for its decision. It had an independent basis based on the Daubert factors and based on the plethora of evidence that it had before it to find that these tools were reliable and that the testimony was admissible. And so again, because the circuit court did exactly what circuit courts should do under 90702, we ask that this court affirm the decisions below and the admission of the evidence here. If there are no further questions. Thank you.
Before I address Justice Gableman's question from the end of my initial presentation, I'd just like to say, when the state says that there was no evidence behind Jones's criticisms of the MnSOSTR and the razor, that's just not true. I mean, there were journal articles submitted. The original paper for the razor was submitted. The original paper for the MnSOS3, which replaced the MnSOSTR, was submitted. These are the sources of the criticisms or the problems with the instrument.
I didn't think she said that there were no criticisms. She said there were theories, but there was no expert opinion given that they were not reliable. At least that's what I thought.
Well, Dr. Waller did opine that they were not reliable, but he did provide a basis for it. I thought that I heard her say that was unsupported by evidence, and that's just not the case.
Counsel, on that point, the state says that Dr. Waller admitted, this is at page 13 of the state's brief, Dr. Waller admitted that, as explained in a published article submitted by Jones, the MnSOS-R has been one of the most widely used sexual recidivism tools, and its predictive accuracy is on the whole similar to that of other risk assessment instruments. Did Dr. Waller admit that?
He admitted, when we were discussing before, the AUC, ROC, the difference between that and the actual validity of the risk percentages given, he agreed that it's 0.71 or 0.72. I would also agree that the MnSOS-R has been one of the most widely used tools.
Okay,
the key there is has been.
You used a couple of acronyms there with which I'm unfamiliar.
I'm sorry. AUC, Area Under the Curve, which is generated by the what's called the Receiver Operating Curve. And those are both ways of deciding, as I think we both agree, whether a particular tool does a good job of saying, you know, this guy's more dangerous than that guy. Not whether it says accurately that, you know, the percentages that it gives and that are told to the jury are valid.
Okay. And further on that point, the state provided the results of the static R, static 99, the static 99R, as well as the results from the MnSOS-R and the razor, and noted that they were all within a few percentage points of each other. Should that be a significant factor to us?
Once again, I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, you know, if the fact that I have, you know, some evidence of something doesn't mean that any other evidence that comes in ought to come in. We still have to look at each piece of evidence on its own and decide whether it has merit.
True, but your position is that Razor and MnSOS-R are unreliable and yet produced results similar to two tests that you don't challenge.
Well, that's correct. I mean, the fact that, again, the fact that an instrument generates a particular number in a particular case and that it happens to be the same as another instrument doesn't tell us that both instruments are equivalently reliable.
Before your time is up, I would like to hear you answer Justice Gableman's question,
if you
can, please.
I mean, I guess my overall assessment of what the court's decision was, its oral ruling, is that it was more talking about applying Daubert than applying Daubert itself. You know, it recited the standards. It recited the factors. You know, with respect to testing, it said these instruments have been tested, which is certainly true. The question is, have those tests justified their use in the way that they're used? And you won't see any discussion of that in the opinion.
Well, so is the Court of Appeals wrong in its assessment of what the trial court did?
Well, I mean, you can read, you know, the trial court's decision is just a few pages long. I mean, obviously, I think the Court of Appeals assessment is wrong. That's why I petitioned here.
Well, Mr. Henkel, that's an obvious answer, but it seems that the Court of Appeals made rather specific observations about what the court did. The court found that the state's expert witnesses testified that the instruments, quote, were the product of sufficient facts or data and the product of reliable principles and methods, end quote. Was the Court of Appeals mistaken as far as what they reported, what the trial court said, Mr. Henkel?
No, the circuit court certainly said that, but that's just the standard. That's purely conclusory. It's like saying, you know, it found him guilty. I mean, yeah, the question is whether the underlying, you know, underlying logic supported that conclusion.
Okay.
Shall I continue? I can
address
this. Standards more. With respect to general acceptance, it said, these instruments have been used, which, as I said, is true. The question is, are they used now? We can't keep going on a loop and saying, well, these were once valid, and therefore they're always valid. I mean, it's still the law in Wisconsin that bite mark evidence is admissible because of a case from 1986. Even though that evidence has been discredited, disavowed by everyone in the field, I could stand before you and say, hey, bite mark evidence produces a moral certainty of guilt. Would that be correct? Would that satisfy Daubert? Well, no, it wouldn't. But I couldn't point to any law saying that. I see my time has elapsed.
It is.
Thank you. Well, thank you both for another look at Daubert and how we are to apply it in Wisconsin. We're going to take a brief recess so counsel may leave and other counsel may come in for our second case of the morning. We are adjourned.